don't rattle no more. Good Lord, I'm feeling lighter.
We gotta ban this song. This is the U.S. World Cup theme. The team's theme. It's terrible. I got Joe Kelly has the Portugal theme later. We're going to play that.
Hey.
I'm honorary Portuguese this month.
The last time we weren't very happy with a song for a team, that team went off far. And did amazing.
They went far. That's right. 803-0550.
Would you have preferred it to be Kickstart My Heart?
Yes.
As a World Cup theme.
Yes, it would have been better than that. 803-0550 if you want to join us. Jeremy and Joe, happy Thursday. The World Cup begins in 7 hours. 3 o'clock today.
I feel like it would be a public service to let everybody know that the Knicks did win last night, by the way.
Yes.
Because I think every time someone wakes up, they might be learning from us that the Knicks won last
night. That's right. Nick Mandola? The Knicks won. Yeah. And we've got a Nick on to talk about
Knicks,
it.
Knicks Nick?
Yeah. The Knicks.
No, I don't actually know if you're a Knicks fan.
No, I'm not. I'm a Celtics fan. But I have so many friends who are Knicks fans from going to UB, you know, because UB is the furthest you can get away from New York City and still pay in-state tuition. So I'm happy for a lot of them right now.
Well, good. It was a wake up and check the phone. Holy cow, there's no way that actually happened. So the Knicks are up 3-1. And, Nick, let me ask you this. Like, Nick Mandola, NBC Sports, on the World Cup here. You're covering the event. You're going to a bunch of the games. We're going to have you on, you know, post-U.S. games. Would I be right to say that the last World Cup blended in with other sports because it was in the winter, and that's why it feels like it's been a while since I've seen the World Cup kind of take over the U.S. and take over the sports scene? Now it's back in the summer, and you feel like it will?
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. I mean, it was also in Qatar, right? So there was this, I don't want to say that it was bad or good, but the vibe wasn't as good. Like, people are, look, there's a lot of problems right now with the World Cup in the U.S., but more people are traveling to the U.S. There's and Canada and Mexico. There's going to be more atmosphere. So I'm avoiding the political discussion. I think just less people went to Qatar. There was less to do there in terms of, you know, what we were celebrating outside of the sport, and that's nothing against them. I just think in the summer, away from most of all the other sports, and I think there's a lot more expectation around the United States as well. I think that can't help but help.
Yeah.
180,000 tickets, by the way, unsold, Nick. No, we talked about this last time. they're not going to be empty seats, right? They're gonna find a way to sell those, right? Or is it too soon?
There's a conspiracy theory going around, and I'm trying to, you know, play my part in it. I'm not going to lie to you, because I want to take my son to a game independent of the work I have to do, and it's just been brutal. But the conspiracy theory is that FIFA wants to save face, and so they're only going to release cheaper tickets through the secondary market. And I'm kind of like, as much as I would hate that, I'm kind of hoping that's the case, because it's brutal. I mean, the cheapest tickets I found as of a couple of days ago were for games in Toronto, like Senegal versus Iraq, or I think it was in Philadelphia, if I'm Curacao, Ivory Coast, and you were still talking like cheapest seat, $250-$300.
Yeah. Nick Mandola joining us on the World Cup as things get started today. Mexico, South Africa, and South Korea and Czechia. The U.S. plays tomorrow night. All right, Nick, to the U.S. Last we spoke, they had not yet played their two friendlies, the warm-up games. And I think by most accounts, those went pretty well, right? Like, the outcome, whatever, it's a friendly, and not every top lineup is in. What were your takeaways from how the U.S. warm-up games ultimately looked?
Well, first of all, you have to contrast them to their last two. So they've scheduled, credit to them, some very, very good teams. And that helps because the very, very good teams wanted to play games in the U.S. before the tournament. And Belgium and Portugal and back in March wiped the floor with them. So there was a chance for them to kind of, I don't want to say remedy that, but rebuild the hype with Senegal, very good. Probably the best, if not the second best team in Africa, and then Germany, who is always good. And Senegal, they beat, and they looked good. At worst, fine. Germany, they lost, and they looked excellent. They were without their best defender. You could say that both of the goals were at least in part down to a player who probably won't play because Chris Richards, the star center back, was being saved for tomorrow. So guys, you'll love this. In my analysis article, I quoted Lindy Ruff. I said they filled the hope tank, if you remember that back from, what was it? Yeah, they went a long way, not just themselves, but with the average American fan. They filled the hope tank.
That's good. One of my questions conceptually, Nick, is like, why will it be different this time around? Joe mentioned earlier, you know, the golden generation, and there are more players maybe in this World Cup team that are playing in high-profile club teams than
way,
in years
way
past.
Way more that are playing in Europe.
Yeah, way more. So will it be because, the Jimmys and Joes are better, or will it be the X's and O's? They got a coach that rates a little bit better. Are they structurally better? Are they talented more so? Is it both? Then, and that's why things should go better this time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is yes on both, and there's the third. Well, there's four things, right? It's on home soil. That is a huge, huge help. And the tournament's bigger. There are more chances for you to not just get out of the round, because it's not just the first two teams in your group. Some third place teams will make it. And if you are to win your group, I think it's a guarantee you're getting a third place team, because it's set up for the hosts in the next round. So I just think the hype is there, and we'll talk about the team and the players, but not just that. They've played all three teams in their group. I mean, the perfect twist of fate within the last year and a half, and they beat two of them on American soil. So and a lot of this golden generation guys played in a World Cup together already. So there is every reason to believe it will be different this time. I read something the other day. Someone was, I don't want to say ripping on, but they're like, it was Landon Donovan's like, hey, we made it to the quarterfinals in 2002 and we haven't made the right progress. We haven't, made it further than that since. I said, all right, so to make it to the quarterfinals, you're one of the best eight teams in the world. And even the U.S. at its most confident would say, I don't know that we're one of the eight best programs in the world. Like, this is the sport in the entire world. I gave a presentation where my wife teaches, and I won't say what school because, Jerry, you're very familiar with it. I made a presentation to the fifth and sixth graders there the other day, and I did the math for them. 1.5 billion people watched the World Cup. 126 million? Was the streaming figure something like that from the last Super Bowl? It is impossible to state, whether you like soccer or not, how many teams in the world are powerful and how many people care about this. So if we're judging by a standard of, is this potentially the best, most talented, best coach U.S. team, men's team, I should say, to ever play at a World Cup, it feels potential-wise unequivocally yes.
Yeah. Right, and the result doesn't have to equal that, right? Like, Morocco made the semis last World Cup. That doesn't mean they're one of the four best programs in the world.
Right.
So when thinking about that, though, like, what do you look at as their potential to do what Donovan said? Like, make it to the quarterfinals and even go, further than that would be insane. The question I wonder for that, Nick, because I feel like if they just do their job and don't really implode, they'll do well in the group and win a knockout round if they get a third place team, like you said. I still wonder, like, what they'll look like against those good European teams, not even maybe like the best teams in the world, but like your Belgiums that they've played in the past, or the Netherlands when they've been at World Cups. And I don't know, the Germany game wasn't, I know they lost, but they had the ball a lot. And I feel like when they've had games like that in past World Cups, they're always on their heels.
Yes, and I would expect that once it gets to the World Cup, it will not quite look that way if they line up against a Germany. Antonio Rudiger did not play for Germany, just the same way that I said that Chris Richards didn't play for the U.S. I don't think it'll be as possession heavy for them. But I do think they now have a guy who is not looking to, I don't want to say outthink the opponent, because everyone's looking to outthink the opponent. But with Berhalter, who I liked just fine, there were just some moments, like in the knockout rounds against Netherlands, where he starts a forward, Jesus Ferreira, who I don't remember if he hadn't played in the tournament or if he hadn't started in the tournament, and they basically eliminated the center forward position for 45 minutes because he looked lost. And the stakes here are just so high that the experience factor does matter. And I know we talked about this. Jeremy and I, I start working together with him 20 years ago at GR, and I think we were early on the, like, get rid of terms like, you know, we say the word momentum too often, experience too often, that sort of thing. But I do think in these scenarios that it is a variable, and it's a very real variable. And it's one of the reasons I'm nervous with the U.S. is they have a keeper who's probably not going to start, who played a whole World Cup, whereas the other guy we haven't seen there. And there's just something to that experience level when you're going up against a team that has better pedigree and years of tradition on their side.
Nick Mendola joining us, previewing the World Cup, which gets started today, Mexico and South Africa, the first game. So, Nick, in the group, the first matchup for the U.S. is Paraguay. I mean, let's do like what a shouty show would do. Is that a must win? Like they really kind of have to come out with a win, because by all accounts, the toughest opponent in the group is Turkey, and that's the third game that they've got. So maybe Australia is the weak link. Is this a game you feel like they've got to have?
Whew. Yes, I do. But I think it's again, not to advance, but to set their expectations and to put themselves in that driver's seat for winning Group D, because I think they can win their first two games. And it's Turkey A, that's how we're supposed to say it now. Turkey A is very good. I think they're a team that they beat the U.S. last summer, and there's a very real chance there for the U.S. to go 3-0 in the group, but it just doesn't always seem to go that way. And you want to go into that game knowing the stakes, like feeling the stakes in terms of winning the group, because if you finish first, you're playing on July 1st in Santa Clara against the third-place team from one of five groups. And when you're playing the third-place team from the group, like look at any other group, an England or a Germany or a Portugal, maybe they slip out of first in their group, but they're not dropping to third, right? And you're giving yourself to wet your feet in the West Coast. By the way, they're staying in the West Coast, I believe, unless they make the round of 16.
Yeah, it's Inglewood, Seattle, and Inglewood. Yeah, all their games are out West.
Right. So if they win their round of 32 game and they go to the round of 16, it's the first time they'll have to leave the West Coast. Other teams will be moving across the country potentially to meet them. So get your feet wet in the round of 32 as a favorite before you have to sweat that game of, all right, now we're here potentially playing, you know, the winner of Group G is the way that they're looking. Not to project too far down the line, because I know you asked me about the first game, but the winner of Group G, guys, round of 16 versus Belgium. We've been there before. Or it's Egypt with Mo Salah. So for me, this is a situation where winning the first game is a must win for the spirit, for the expectation, for that golden generation thing you mentioned. It's telling Australia, yes, listen, we're here, we're doing as we expected, and now you're coming in here. And it's getting to that Turkey A game at, you know, having that potential to be 2-0 going into that game.
So to this point, like, for anyone that doesn't know, the field is expanded, and it used to be
48.
First and second in the group is going to get through, right? You're there, and you're going to cross over. If you win the group, you're going to play a second place team in the crossover group, and vice versa. But this format is not just that; it is third place teams that make it. So the standings will basically kind of look like wild card standings. And are we very likely to see deep tiebreakers here, Nick, to find the eight best third place teams?
Yeah, I have no idea. Very likely, I would say it feels at least likely, if not very likely. But we know we've never really been here before, because it's not just that it's 8 of 12 third-place teams, right? Yeah. So that's why I said the U.S. has such a great chance to get through. If they don't win a game at this World Cup, they'll be humiliated. They win one game, they'll have a very good chance, right? Like, that's what you're looking at, because there are going to be groups where teams go where there's a team with three draws or a team with just one win, and win one game and you're putting yourself in position to pick up a draw and go to the next round. Like, this is, especially in this group, it's not a weak group, guys. Like, that's the thing I'd like to point out. It is a favorable group, but, you know, all of these teams, I think the average, someone said, and by someone, I mean like FIFA or a real report I read. The average team in this group is, like, we do the mean, median, mode situation from school, right?
Yeah.
They're all around the same. There just isn't, like, the U.S. being the power is good news for the other three teams in the group.
So the way that tiebreakers work, if you go further, far enough down, like, in the you got first places through, second places through, third place, it will go to most points, of course, goal differential, most goals, all the way down. Fair play, which has been used, yeah, is it once or twice before? And
correct.
The seventh tiebreaker is just the FIFA world ranking. So
yeah,
you get all the way down to that, like, oh, sorry, they have a higher ranking than you, they go through.
Yeah, in a completely flawed system, by the way, because FIFA ranks teams by when they're playing in meaningful games, right? Like if you're in South America, you get a win against a really good South American team. There's 10 teams in South America. Most of their games are played against each other, and almost all of the teams are good. Whereas the U.S. can play a meaningful game, with all due respect to El Salvador, against El Salvador, and it's easier to beat El Salvador, even in El Salvador, than it is for, you know, Peru to beat Brazil. So, it again, even that is favorable to a CONCACAF team.
Yeah, and in fair play is like if you get a yellow card, it's minus a point. We could watch a team miss the knockout stage because of a yellow card or a red card somewhere along the way.
Nick, what's Pulisic on the line for him? Like, are we talking about him already being one of the greatest player in U.S. history? Does he need this tournament to play? I mean, he's 27 years old, so it's not like he'd be done after this, but he's been around for a decade now, and you would think this is like the squarely in the prime of his career.
Yeah, listen, a couple of years ago, you guys asked me, is he all ready? And Jeremy texted me the night before. I answered, and he goes, okay, we're talking about this on the radio tomorrow. He's there on the cusp. Like, we're talking about that at 27. This is someone who, the year they missed the World Cup, still nearly willed them at 18, or was he 17 even, like, right into the World Cup. He is an exceptional talent. He's a driven competitor. He doesn't get as much pub, I think, or as much favorable pub around here sometimes because his interviews are a little suspect in terms of charisma, I might say. But he is exceptional. He was the best player on AC Milan last year. This season, for the first half of the season, he was their best player. He can change a game through creativity, through drive. He is literally going to be the focus of every opposition. He'll be up there for one of the most fouled players in the tournament for as long as the U.S. go. And if he has a halfway decent tournament, if he's a strong part of the reason that they win a knockout round game, the discussion becomes, has he passed Dempsey? To me, it's Dempsey. A lot of people say Dempsey or Donovan, and all the respect in the world to Landon Donovan. It's not a problem to be the second best player in your national team's history. But for me, because of the what Dempsey did on a club level as well, between Fulham and Tottenham, and what Pulisic has done on a club level, the tiebreaker goes to the World Cup. And we can point to Clint Dempsey moments at the World Cup. We can point to him scoring against big teams and groups of death, the same way we can point to Donovan scoring against Algeria in one of the most memorable World Cup wins of all time. So that's where we're at with Pulisic. If he can lock down an iconic moment, and I think the odds are in his favor, or an iconic win, or man, the U.S. went 3-0 and, you know, their guy was there for every bit of it. And, you know, it gets a lot harder to say it's not a discussion, but it is. Yeah, I mean, very strong chance. Guys, if he has his moment, you might say he's already there.
Yeah.
Outside the U.S., Nick, who's the worst team you think could win the whole thing?
The worst team that could chop. You asked the best question, sir.
how many teams could we get there to? Like, where's the cutoff?
I mean, you can talk me into 10 to 12, I would say, a quarter of the field, because, you know, there are real questions. And I know this is such a goofy thing to say, but when you see the reports, and we've talked about this before, you know, of some teams like England, like, man, is it hot here? Guess who's not worried about it? All the South American teams. A lot of the African teams. The host nations do well at these things. And there are three host nations, so you have to give very real consideration. Canada's not going to leave Canada. The U.S. won't leave the U.S. Mexico won't leave Mexico for quite some time. So, I mean, you've got your standard fare. You've got your France's. You've got your Germany's. You've got, you know, England, of course. I think they're a fantastic team. But then you start to look. Like, Morocco made that run, and they're a fantastic team coming out of Japan is a dark horse as well. So, and there are four or five teams in South America I like. So if you made me dig for it, I could probably get you to 15. I think I could get you to 15.
Wow, 15. Meanwhile, Joe put together a League of Nations. We had a pool.
Yes.
We drafted all 48 teams, 12 people.
Four each.
Four picks each. Who should have been the first pick? Owen Parker, parlay killer, goalie, analyst, extraordinaire. He had the first pick. Who should the first pick have been?
France.
That's who he took. Who should be the second pick?
Yeah. Oh, boy. You'll laugh, but England.
England went four.
They went four.
If Harry Kane, if he was Brazilian, people would talk about him like Messi, but he's English and he's got a little bit of a goofy voice, but yeah, England.
He does have a voice that the first time you hear it, it absolutely shakes you. The first time you're like, "Whoa, I didn't see that coming."
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah. Argentina, I think, would be in your top four.
They went five.
Spain would be in there.
They went two.
So, which we're saying here is Jeremy took was reaching when he took Portugal at three.
I had to take Portugal.
I don't think
that's not a reach.
Not a reach?
The only reason it's a reach is for the – you're going to grow very, very tired of this discussion. But it's should Cristiano Ronaldo still be starting?
Right.
Because he's 41. Right. He's an icon. He's got statues all over Portugal. And, frankly, they're better with him coming off the bench.
Yep.
But it's like, you know, it's telling Pele. You know, like, hey, bro, have a seat.
Right.
Thanks for all you've done. But they, yes, no, Portugal can win the tournament. Portugal could have won the last two tournaments with a younger Ronaldo, and now you're talking about a player who's still fine, but is one of the greatest of all times and should be coming off the bench. And I imagine by the time they get to the knockout rounds, it's going to be, hey, buddy, you want to win a World Cup?
Yeah.
But he is starting going into it?
He started the last couple of games.
Okay.
He has had a few moments where you're thinking, I don't know, dude. Your country still really wants to win a World Cup, and you have the biggest ego of anyone, well, outside of politics, and you might want to sit this one out.
Am I right in thinking that Mo Salah, did he miss the last World Cup? He got hurt right before it?
I think he checks out.
And did he come back for the second or third game,
but was
limited? But yeah, there was a real World Cup scare. I don't remember.
Okay.
That World Cup, you mentioned it being like going into the abyss. For me, I mean, working at NBC, the Premier League is like all, you know, it's like such a big focus for us. And then all of a sudden it was like, hey, we're going to take a pause. And then in a week and a half, World Cup.
Yeah.
And so it's still very muddled for me outside of the U.S. games.
They did not qualify for the last World Cup.
Was it because he got hurt in qualifying?
Maybe. They lost to, there was a, remember the laser controversy? It was like Egypt and Senegal.
Oh my God, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Yes, there was the shining lasers in the players' fences during penalties.
Right.
Yes,
and
I totally recall.
They missed the World Cup because of that. And it was like, you watch the video of it, it's not like one guy with a laser. Like, remember Kyle Orton?
Yeah.
It was like one guy with a laser. This was like 50 lasers like being shot at these guys.
It was crazy.
Insane.
It was insane. How did I forget that? Yeah. Wow.
Nick Mendola, NBC Sports, NBC Soccer. All right, Nick, finally, who's the pick? Who's going to win?
Oh, boy. All right, listen, I have had a gut feeling for a long time that it's going to be Brazil. And a part of it is the side, you know, it's the hemispheric thing. It's the kind of spirit behind it. They haven't reached their levels in some time. They watched Argentina do it. I think I've watched, you know, their games with Argentina show me that both of those sides are kind of lethal. They've just got to get the clinical finishing out of their forwards. I mean, that's the thing. Who's going to step up for them? Because at the midfield with Bruno Guimarães, Casemiro, even as we saw with Manchester United and his renaissance, I really feel like Brazil is going to do it. The odds say France, though. France are too deep, like at every position. They might be three. They cut a team of players who could win a group at the World Cup.
Yeah.
Like, this is as deep as it gets. And one of the subplots of the entire tournament is the first, I think it's the first game for them, France against Senegal, where there's a huge controversy, if you're in France, is that how many of French players come from Senegal via either colonization or a French-speaking nation, et cetera. So I think France, it's the easy money. That's the easy money bet, right? It's betting the Dodgers to win the division, right? This is the best team with the deepest team. And if there was a payroll, the deepest payroll.
Yeah. Nick Mendola, soccer writer for NBC Sports on the Western Hotline. We'll talk next week, Nick. We'll get a Game 2 U.S. preview, look back at the Paraguay game, which is tomorrow night. So enjoy the tournament. We'll talk next week.
Thank you very much, sirs.
World Cup today, Mexico and South Africa. Do you want Mexico, again, is El Tri. That's their team kind of name.
Yep.
And South Africa is Bafana Bafana, which translates to the boys, the boys.
Nice.
Yes, exuberant fan base.
They scored.
They cheer that during games.
When the World Cup was in South Africa in 2010, the opening game, I remember someone from South Africa, Sabalana maybe is the guy. I think he played in Europe.
Arlo White's on the call.
He scored from like the moon. It was like the first goal of the tournament, and he was so far away, and it was he just lasered it in there. World Cup memories.
Yeah,
that's my only South Africa World Cup memory, though.
The South Africa World Cup, I was in Amsterdam for the final when Spain played the Netherlands.
Okay. I remember all the U.S. games being very dark. Maybe it was the time of day. Like, it was pitch black.
That was the Vuvuzela.
Because they also didn't have big stadiums.
There's two things I remember from that cup. Vuvuzelas, endlessly.
Oh,
and number two is a very, very deep pull, and I don't expect anyone else to remember this. I'm pretty sure I've got this lined up. Peter King covered that World Cup for Sports Illustrated.
Okay.
And he lamented that in the stadium, there was not a clock to tell him what the time was.
Like the actual time.
Like what time is it?
Not the game time. Like the time of the day.
Right. And people's responded, the actual game clock, just add the time to it. Like it's soccer, we start the game on time.
Right.
If it says 45 minutes in and the game started at noon, it's 12:45.
Right.
Like you can do the math on what time it is without a clock.
Right. They will start today's first game at 3 o'clock.
And it will start.
Well, right?
The
U.S. won't poison soccer and start time stuff,
too. I don't want a movie preview poison this game. This game better start at 3. FIFA.
We went to a 6:30 movie the other day, showed up at 6:57, and the movie had not started yet.
I got to walk around for a minute. That makes me so mad.
You got to add a half hour.
You got
to add a half hour.
It's so upsetting that
it was just starting. Yeah. It was like 20. It was 20. I made sure to remember 27 minutes after the official start time.
We got to break in. I got to walk around. I got to take a walk.
I have the Bills 6th or 7th, and I can be swayed either or. So the teams I have comfortably ahead of them. I think the Houston Texans, Jacksonville Jaguars, the Denver Broncos, I think the New England Patriots. Where I hem and haw with them are the Los Angeles Chargers. I think Ladd McConkey has been better more recently than DJ Moore, but if you were to tell me DJ Moore has a better year, I'm open to that idea. Quentin Johnson had a resurgent year last year in year 3. Where do you compare that with Khalil Shakir?
Carl Jones, Channel 4. Mike Schoep and the Bulldog here. Are you ankle deep even into the NFL player prop streets yet for 2026? I'll hang up and listen.
You know, I appreciate the question. I'll take the question, but you know, of course not. No, of course not.
That's Sean McDermott.
That's not something I would dabble in.
If you asked, remember how if you asked Sean McDermott a question he didn't want to answer, he would say, "I appreciate that question. I know why you're asking." And then he would say nothing.
Right.
"I appreciate that question. You should not appreciate that question. I knew the answer before I even spat it out." Of course you're not in the ankles, the whatever.
No.
Player prop street. I'm not even sure Sam would be.
I'm not. I don't even know where the street is. I haven't even loaded it into my maps yet. I don't know how to get there.
Sam's over here moving and starting new jobs. As avid a competitor as Sam is, I doubt he's, well, we'll find out. Sam Paniatovich, Fox Sports, Fox Chicago with us on the West Shore Hotline. Are you into, I mean, you're not drafting fantasy teams, I'm pretty sure. Are you into individual NFL stuff yet? Maybe awards?
No, and I heard you bring up you were looking for the exact order of the Atlantic Division, and I'm like, I really hope he doesn't ask me to do that because I haven't even right. Mike, I haven't even found a place to live yet, let alone think about next hockey season.
Well, yeah, let the record show. Yet here you are on a summer Friday at 3:30 with us. You are a horse, is what you are.
I'm glad you said horse with an S. Thank you so much for saying that. If there was ever a question about how much I love this show, I moved to Chicago Monday and went through the first 4 days of work. I get off work yesterday at Hallis Hall, which is where the Bears practice, and I'm driving back to the south side with my photographer, and tornadoes are ripping through Chicago. Like, no joke. Like, severe storms, tornadoes. Most of the south side of Chicago, like from 95th to 111th, where I'm hanging out the last couple days, is without cell phone service.
Wow.
So my buddy that I'm staying with doesn't have Wi-Fi either. They knocked his Wi-Fi out. So I drove from his house like 20 minutes away just to have cell service to talk to you two.
Come on.
Let the record show, I did not ask you anything about the hockey standings.
No.
I don't want to be blamed for that. Just nope. Because you thought I might. I don't want to be blamed for that. I had no intention of asking you about next year's hockey standings.
Nor did I demand you get in your car and drive across town so you could do the show. But it's very considerate. Flattering. And we definitely appreciate you.
Yes.
There's no question.
We should pretty much let you talk about whatever you want.
How's how is the gig? Like, I saw you tweeting, you mentioned Hallis Hall. I saw you tweet a picture of, I don't know if it was your first day there or whatever. How are you digging the gig?
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, I've been all over TV. We do news all day and then sports in between, and we have a sports show and all that. So that's all fun. But I'm just like, this is where I grew up, and this is where I'm, happy to be back. I covered Bulls, Bears, Cubs, Sox, and Hawks for forever, and then moved to Vegas, moved to Boston for betting. But now I'm like back talking about actual sports. So, I'm going to have a lot less DMs this football season telling me nice pick, bitch. That's going to be very nice. Because, when you do betting every day, you're going to lose a lot. So it's more of a focus on just the players and the teams. I'll still be doing betting for Fox Sports, and we'll talk betting, of course, during football season. But I'm at practice yesterday, the last day of Bears mini camp. And look, Caleb Williams threw a seed 45 yards to Luther Burden. And I know it's mini camp, but holy crap, guys, what a throw. And then it gets put on social media, and everybody's like, oh! I mean, it's a throw on the third day of Bears minicamp, and now we're talking about Caleb Williams for MVP. Can we just have nice things? It's June. Can we pump the brakes on this stuff?
Yeah, but no. Who wants to pump the brakes on that? I think you would know much better. I think you're going back to Chicago at a very exciting time, and the Bears are by far the number one reason for that. I mean, the Cubs are the Cubs. The White Sox are interesting and fun, and you and I are enjoying that. It's your team. But the Bears right now, Sam, your followers, apologies in advance, your followers are reacting to this pass play because they've never seen the Bears throw the ball before successfully in their lives. So that you've got the quarterback. The quarterback is on the cover of Madden. And I think he's like, when you get there, we can talk about it, a kind of cool MVP pick idea, like these 12-1 or thereabouts. So, you could do worse. You could have somebody like Allen that takes over the town.
No doubt. And he's got all the tools. When I think of arm talent, I think of Jay Cutler. And then, Kyle Orton kind of had an arm, but that's the conversation in Chicago history.
That is so sad.
Caleb's got... I know, right? It's brutal.
It's amazing.
But look, in terms of upside, and we talked when we built our 8-leg division parlays last Friday, I ended up putting Detroit in Detroit's favor to win the NFC North. I just think Detroit has the best roster, 53-man. But in terms of coach and quarterback, to me, it's not even close who has the most upside. And you're going to see a lot of Bear support. I mean, last summer when Caleb was learning the Ben Johnson offense, which is very extensive and very like high octane and very tough to master, Caleb was 40-1 to win the MVP, like 35-40-1. And now he's 15 or lower. This is a real thing. He is, And when he takes the snap now, I mean, think about all the weapons he's got. You got Luther Burden. You got Rome Odunze. They love this rookie from LSU, Xavion Thomas, who's just an unbelievable all-SEC receiver. Colston Loveland, a top 15 pick last year out of Michigan, a tight end. Cole Kmet, another tight end. They love Swift. They love Manunga. I mean, this offense should be elite. And Caleb yesterday was talking about how he thinks that they could lead the NFL in scoring offense. And I'm like, all right, well, it all sounds good. I don't know if they're going to stop anybody, but they're going to score for sure.
Yeah, the coach really, really won me over. I was skeptical, not quite. We need to be into July for training camp. But when training camp was starting and he would be like sort of abrasive toward Williams and really aggressive about correcting mistakes and stuff, I wondered, I think even I said it on the show a time or two, I don't know if I did it when you were on with us, like, is he one of these guys that's the wizard in the classroom and drawing up all the stuff but doesn't have the people skills to really be a good, I'm thinking about Josh McDaniels, maybe the first couple times around where he sort of flamed out as a head coach. Like, does he have that piece? And turns out he does. I mean, he's in that room with the shirt off and the victory speeches and all of it. Like, I'm totally in on this guy. Bad read by me last summer, because I think he's you've got a great one there, I think.
I think so, too. And, you know, it's natural to look at it, and it, not just a Chicago conversation. Any team that plays over its skis with a very young quarterback and a very young head coach. Not that Ben Johnson's young, but he was a first-year head coach last year with a second-year quarterback. Usually, whoever that team is, wise guys are going to say under the next year. You know? They just are. They're going to bet on regression, and they're going to say, well, this team has a tougher schedule, and everybody's seen the plays and all that. I talked to one guy who bets a lot of NFL, and he goes, look, I naturally lean under. But Ben Johnson scares the hell out of me. And I said, all right, I'll print that. Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure the Bills ever would have had a sniff of Burden last year, but he's easily somebody in this years-long thirst we've had here for a wide receiver in the draft that we can imagine being like an all-time great. Burden was one of those guys last year.
That was your idea for them last year, I think.
I loved him. Because, you know, the guys that have sort of the weird negatives, I feel like, just let's not overthink this. Here's a stud. But what happened was the Bears picked him at 39 with the pick they got from Carolina from the Bryce Young trade. They had Carolina's second, so they had that pick. And then they had the other second right after that. They traded that to the Bills, and the Bills picked TJ Sanders with that pick. And then now DJ Moore, who was in that first Bears-Panthers trade, is here, which means nothing to this. But, well, one thing it means is, like, there's just more bandwidth for Burden to be great, or even Odunze with the Bears. We can't just talk about the Bears every week with Sam going forward, right? We can't just do that. We can't have a Bears segment.
I don't think that's sustainable. No.
Well, let's do what the people want, and that's look at the College World Series
right, Sam,
schedule.
Right. Texas, is that tomorrow night, right?
What are we looking at tomorrow?
Yeah, double elimination. So it's down to 8 now in Omaha. And Texas and Georgia play double elim. So you get that first one tomorrow, and then you feel good about finishing it off in game 2 or game 3. As we talked about before the whole bracket started, this is what you want. You want to beat Omaha, and I still believe Texas is the most complete team, but now you're facing a Georgia team that is as good. I mean, everybody here is good, obviously. I saw that Troy was on the list. I'm like, I'm going through the teams of College World Series. Troy and West Virginia are playing right now. Just like we thought, Bulldog, Troy would be in the College World Series.
How do they get to play each other? How do they seed this thing?
Well, just like how the bracket, like, you know, they do all these, like, regions. There's 8 different regions, and then it's just bracket style. Like, there's no, like, pull names out of a hat or anything. So Troy, West Virginia, Ole Miss, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Alabama, Texas, and Georgia. And on this show 3 weeks ago, we talked about Texas at plus 950 or so. So I'm feeling good. But more importantly, I don't know if you guys have been following the content on social media. There's a bar in Omaha called Rocco's, and they do this Jell-O shot challenge. And every school in the field of the 8 has a color.
Yes.
And whoever wins the Jell-O shot challenge, charities and all that kind of stuff, there's a lot of money going around. West Virginia, in I believe 2 days, has taken 7,900 Jello shots in Omaha, Nebraska.
We talked about this last year.
Yes,
we did. It was new to me last
yes,
year.
Right. The South sounds familiar, yes.
West Virginia.
7,900?
Showing up.
Yeah, that tracks, I think.
Yeah, I didn't want to say
well,
that.
Then, for context, the next closest school is, let's Nine. See, Ole Miss has 2,000. West Virginia has 7,900.
Right. Jeez. Tell me about Jello shots. That's never been my thing. Like, how fast does it affect you? How many do you take before it sort of, 1, 10? What's the experience?
Yeah, how much alcohol content is there in a Jello shot?
What if I
Sam?
Take 2? Am I
do you know
wrecked?
Well, if I'm making them, it might take you 2. It depends on yeah. It depends on who the pourer is for sure. But I believe now they're professionally made. They claim there's a shot in every one, like a shot of alcohol. But I'm like, that doesn't make sense because if you actually hold a Jello shot. It's built to hold, like that cup, the shot cup that it's in is a shot. So there's no way it's all vodka. It can't be right. A full shot of vodka, can it?
I would think no.
So it's up to Rocco in the end, how much alcohol is in there.
Right.
I did shots
I
with my
idea.
I did shots with my sister and father-in-law last night. And
I'm going to bring
on a Thursday.
I'm going to bring Jello shots. Sorry, Mike. Okay, I'm going to bring Jello shots to the Christmas party at Bulldogs. That's what I'm going to do.
That's how you're going to assure yourself an invite. So they asked me, like, what should you pick, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, Jameson.
That's
and
a good, that's
they're
a good,
very happy with that choice.
Shot.
It turned out that, yes.
Choice, I'd say.
Is that the definitive? Family Feud. Is that the number one answer for like a shot drink? Jameson? Crown, maybe?
Yeah, that's up there too. I mean, I think different
Top
regions have different answers to that. And even different bars. But like, Jameson is probably the liquor I've had the most shots of in my life.
All right. Well, maybe that's true of me too. Sam, what a pleasure and an honor. Are you moved in? You're all set? You gotta get back over there.
No, he's staying on somebody's couch with no Wi-Fi.
Well, you gotta
like.
Get back over there and do the rest of the work, it seems.
My entire life is packed up in bins and boxes in Boston. I think I'm going back to Boston in 3 weeks to sell my house, but I'm not sure yet.
All right. Keep us posted. Thanks for your time.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Sam. Much love.
Sam Paniadovich, Fox Sports, Fox Chicago, Fox Moving, Fox Boston, Fox...
Fox
Jello shots.
Yeah, there you go. There it is.
All right. We got to come up with a new plan for Sam. We can't just have a bear segment.
No.
If he's out of the betting thing.
Yeah, I don't know what we do, but I want to accommodate. He wants to keep going.
I want to keep going too. Just got to figure out what we should talk about. I mean, NFL is fine. Just can't always be the Bears. Marty Baron coming up in less than 20 minutes. Mike Schoep and the Bulldog on this sunny Friday. This is WGR.
It's Mike Schoep and the Bulldog.
Well, thank you, Roosevelt. What's the weather like out there?
It's hot. Damn hot. Real hot. Hot than this is my shorts. I can cook things in it. Little crotch pot cooking.
Oh, can you tell me what it feels like?
Fool, when it's hot, I told you again. When you're born on the sun... Damn hot!
It's Mike Schoep.
So damn hot, I saw those two guys in the orange robe burst into flames. It's that hot, you know what I'm talking about.
And the Bulldog.
It's gonna be like tonight, it's gonna be hot and wet. That's nice if you're with a lady, but it ain't no good if you're in the jungle.
It's Mike Schoep and the Bulldog.
Damn hot!
On WGR, Sports Radio 550.
Well, it might be something that someone else finds interesting, but I really only say it because I think it kind of embarrasses me. Never seen Good Morning Vietnam. Is that terrible? On 1 to 10, how bad is that? It's radio.
I don't know. I enjoyed the movie, but I think skipping Slapshot and the Blues Brothers is way more offensive.
I have seen those movies. I just didn't care.
Oh, I thought you've always said you never saw them.
For a while, I had never seen them. But
oh, you have.
I was probably on my phone when they were on. I've never seen The Wire. That was put in my face on ADP chasing on Tuesday night. You've never seen The Wire? Did you not have HBO? No, I had HBO, but I've also never seen The Sopranos. I've got a lot of
you got some work. You
catching
got some
up
work,
to do.
You got some work to do.
Is it worth it? I'm watching Rooster. Do I need The Wire if I'm watching Rooster?
I mean,
there's a lot of good new stuff.
I liked Rooster, but man, you've missed a lot of good TV.
Speaking of missing TV, Marty Baron, are we pulling you away from the Canadian soccer game? I'd hate to be doing that.
No, you're not. I actually was driving around. I had to do some, I had to go get some posts because I'm extending my my chicken coop run into the wooded area. So I needed to get some posts so I could put the chicken wire and the netting and all of that. So that's what I was running around this afternoon to do. But I was listening to you guys, and tequila is the shot that
okay.
I think I have had the most. So then I was like, oh, like Jameson I like, but I don't know that I would say, let's do a shot of Jameson. Crown, yes, but probably tequila, if you ask me.
You good choice. Mrs. Parker loves tequila, and it just never works for me.
Good choice.
I'll turn it down and have something else. You're at the bar and there's half a dozen people, like the bartender comes over, like they're having a shot. You want to have one? Yeah, well, sure. What's everybody having? Tequila. Okay, I'll have something else, please.
Oh, no. Yeah,
I can't do it.
There is a better chance of my wife drinking. No, there is a better chance of my wife eating a ribeye than drinking tequila, and she's a vegetarian.
Oh.
So we have this.
That's not good.
Well, Marty, this image of you tending to chickens is something I need. That's a YouTube channel I would watch.
How many chickens?
Marty Baron tending to chickens is just awesome to me.
I have 6 chickens, 5 hens, and 1 rooster, and the rooster is beautiful, but he's mean and nasty, although I think I've figured it out. The last couple of weeks, I think we've come to an understanding. When I go in the coop, it's to feed them, to give them water, to clean the coop, or to pick up the eggs. I'm not there to attack the hens. I'm not there to cause chaos. And I think we looked at each other in the, straight in the face, and we're on the good path right now.
you've reached a settlement with the aggressive rooster.
I'm interested too. Yes. This is something that you feel like you might have to teach hens and chickens and roosters that like you're there in peace. I'm here to help you.
Yeah, I'm here to help them. And listen, it's I used to have issues with raccoons and fox and hawks and whatnot when we. When we had like chickens, but no rooster, and about maybe like we're going back 2 or 3 years ago on Father's Day, the kids came home with a little box. They went to Tractor Supply and they were like, "Hey, we got you some chicks, but we don't know if any of them are going to be rooster." And one of them was, and it's the best thing because I don't have any raccoons or fox or any critters around the coop or anything because I think he would take on a bear if a bear came around. Yeah, right.
So this is advice, as it happens, for people listening, that you want to have one rooster, at least. Interesting.
You do, and then for some that want to maybe say, hey, let's have chicks, then you can have that whole circle of life with your kids, and you get the incubator, and you get the eggs, and you see which ones are going to be future chicks. So you can do all of that. Yeah, it's National Geographic here in the summer.
Love it. I love it.
Good deal.
So, Marty, I've been thinking about this one question I want to ask you, but I'm not sure if it's not terrible. So it's been, what, a month since the Sabres lost about? And it's the kind of loss that fans like us will never forget, maybe. Just like the other ones from the past, these heartbreaking losses. How do the players do it? Do the players sit around on a day like this and, maybe they think of it, but are you wired in such a way where you can't dwell on the past or just what? I wonder what the damage, if you will, is, like emotionally, whatever, to the players. I mean, most players are on teams that do lose. Only one team ends up winning, so everybody else but the winner is going to have this kind of feeling. How is maybe the average Sabres player feeling today about how it ended, if that's not the wrong
way to put it? I would say that the Sabres now, because they're so young and they're still a young team, you move on a lot quicker when you're young. I think that maybe a Jason Zucker, an older player, or Ryan McLeod, who's still not old, but Alex Tuch to a certain extent, probably thinking like, oh man, that was such a great opportunity. If we had gone through Montreal, we'd have played Carolina. Maybe we beat Carolina and then we end up against Vegas. Like as you get older, you think about it a little bit more because now for most of those Sabres guys, it's like, man, move on to next year. I'm working out. I'm doing my things. I've taken a couple of weeks off. Like I used to say, call me in August. You want me to skate? You know, call me in August. I would take a longer time in the summer to just disconnect from hockey and then get back into the gym. Maybe middle of June, early July. But now they take 2 weeks and they get right back at it. So, but as you're older, maybe you think a little bit more about that was a missed opportunity. And I look at Montreal. Montreal lost in 5 games to Carolina. After they lost, even that night, they lose game 5. They're talking to Suzuki, to Caulfield, to Hudson, and they almost have a smile on their face saying, like, hey, that was great. We lost in conference final. You know, we're going to get right back at it. I don't think you dwell on it when you're younger because you think you're going to get 15 more chances. When you get older, you start to maybe sit around with your friends and a couple beers in the summer and go back like, man, that 2-on-1, Thompson, Benson, right? That would have been R. Right. That chance in the third, Malenstein, like he had the goal, but it got waved off. Maybe you think about it a little bit more as you get older.
Yeah. Also, when you lose in 5, maybe you can just sort of take a drink and like, oh, well. But you lose in overtime of game 7.
Yeah, losing in 5 is not exactly heartbreaking, I don't think. It's disappointing, yeah, for
still
sure.
Think about Carolina in 2006, right, and the way that happened. We had the 20-year reunion. And we're still talking, sitting around and thinking like, man, we thought we had that. And I go back to even Pittsburgh in 01, game 7, Kasparaitis. If I'm sitting with Curtis Brown or, you know, with other guys from that era, and we're like, man, that Mario Lemieux goal in game 6 that went off of Brownie's foot up in the air and then Straka in overtime. I think you're right. Like, how did it happen? Maybe last a little bit longer into the summertime.
And I still remember talking all the time about 25 years later, how the Sabres swept New Jersey that year in the regular season.
That's who they would have drawn in the conference final.
And New Jersey just destroyed Pittsburgh in that round.
Yeah. Well, Marty, you mentioned Tuck, and, you know, at his age, maybe, you know, he's right in between feeling like, you know, this is one of my last best shots. He's certainly not one of the younger guys. The wind seems to be blowing almost exclusively in one direction on predicting what's going to happen there. You want to take your kick at it? Like, what do you think ends up happening with Alex Tuck here?
I think we had Dave Pignota on Sabres Live a couple of days ago, and he said, look, he goes, they're far apart, and if they were closer, probably it would have been done by now. And I go off my own experience. Like, after my 2 years in Philadelphia, and I'm sure Alex Tuck is feeling the same way. He's probably calling his agent every day, every other day. Hey, have you guys talked? What's going on? And I felt like all the way until July 1 that there was a chance that maybe I was going to resign in Philadelphia. Now looking back, I'm like, there was no chance. Like, by June the 10th, I should have known it was not going to happen. Like, we were not close. And I don't even know if the Flyers really gave me like really solid numbers to say we're going to have that. It was kind of like up in the air. Well, maybe we could do this. And I feel like that's probably where this is going. I'm sure the Sabres are keeping line of communication. Tuck is probably wanting to know, hey, are they coming up to where we are? But if it was close, we would have known by now. And probably that contract would have been signed by now, because now the Sabres have to think, okay, well, Zach Benson. Okay, are we talking Byram? Are we re-signing Malenstein? What about Peyton Krebs? Do we have to trade Greenway or McLeod to make room for all of that? Like, there's a lot more than just talk.
Right.
And you got to give yourself some time to do all the other business.
How important, if you're right and Tuck does end up leaving, how important is it, you think, for Jarmo Kekalainen, I'm thinking of the players and like their morale here, because Tuck is such an important piece, and you know they got this far this year, and I'm sure they want to keep the group together. Also understanding it's a business. How important do you think it is for Kekalainen to do something substantial, like a veteran replacement for Alex Tuck, instead of just maybe trying to fill in and hoping like any one of the kids can accumulate enough points to replace Tuck?
I don't think it's that important, because the message is, you know what, you bring in Rasmus Dahlin in the office or you get him on the phone and you're like, listen, like, we wanted to keep Alex. It didn't work out. Now we have to focus on what's next, right? Where do we go? The players that we have, how do we continue to build? I think the biggest thing here is maybe you can kick the tires again on Robert Thomas. Maybe you're calling Detroit, trying to figure out Dylan Larkin or whatnot. But when you look at the roster, and again, I put my roster together, and I'm like, how do they fit everybody that they have under contract right now? Because I think Kulik, Oslin, and Hellenius are three, like, in the top nine, guaranteed for me. Like, mm-hmm. I think Peyton Krebs is probably being bumped out of the top nine. I think Alex Tuch, well, maybe that's, you know, okay, we got players to fill in there. I think there's a possibility. This team could be even better next year without Alex Tuch and without doing anything, you know, as the forward group. I think they're going to try. I think they're going to look to say, hey, you know what? We don't want to just put it on the young kids. But this is also not Briere and Drury leaving. Alex Tuch is a great leader. Alex Tuch is a great player. But losing one is fine. Losing two, like the Sabres did 20 years ago, that was the issue. I think if Drury or Briere had stayed, it would have been a different story.
With Marty Baron, Mike Schoep and the Bulldog on WGR. Thinking of Tuch, and I'm kind of almost assuming that he's gone at this point, but you never know. How would you put it, his importance to what happened this year? I mean, the stats are there, and he's been here a few years. Would you extend it backwards to how he was as a leader, somebody that perhaps when you trade Jack Eichel away, has to establish, you know, some sort of standard within a locker room like that? How deeply rooted was Tuch's impact here?
I remember when he was traded to Buffalo, he's still wearing a red jersey. He was not healthy yet to come back. And the very first practice that he was on the ice, I'm like, oh, like, he's coming from Vegas. And they practice at a different pace. And obviously this group of Sabres that was there back then hadn't gone through what this group this year went to, is making the playoffs and elevated the pace and elevated the practice habits and the details. And so Alex Tuch was a big, big part of the progression that the Sabres took. I want to say, look, Lindy Ruff came in, and it took him a year to evaluate everything. Yarmo came in December of this year. But we're already seeing the progress in the players coming in and one-on-one battles in practice, the compete level in practice. And I think Alex Tuch had a big, big part of the change moving forward. Did that get the Sabres to be in the playoffs before this year? No. Did they need a lot more than Alex Tuch leadership? Yes. They needed a lot of other players' leadership. But I think he's been fantastic. And I think the Sabres are going to miss him if he doesn't resign. That leadership part, the locker room guy, you know, being around the guys on the road, like, he's a big part of that. But that also, you know, there's a business, you mentioned it. You gotta weigh in all of that to make the right decision.
I'm looking at your hockey reference page, which I don't know that you would ever do that. I mean, you'd have to be pretty vain as a player to sort of like have that as a favorite page or tab or anything. But we often joke about the nicknames on these sites, like there are just famous players in sports. Oh. Do you know what yours is on here, Marty?
Yeah, because Duffer and I have talked about it, because whenever a player, we always go to Hockey Reference and we try to see for the nickname. Yep. And I think one of them is Baby Dominator.
That's it. That's your one and only
Baby
nickname.
Baby Dominator.
Baby Dominator. No one has actually ever called you that, right?
Has anyone ever said that to you?
No, never. And actually, the closest to that I've ever gotten is Jim Pizzatelli used to be our athletic trainer. And Pizzo is the one that would give the robes to Rob Ray and Matt Barnaby and Brad May and those guys, like the boxing robe back in the days with Val James in Rochester and whatnot. So he wanted to give me a robe, and he wanted to call me Thermominator because he said I was as thin as a thermometer. So he's like, I'm going to put Thermominator in the back of the robe. We never got to it, but that's as close to the Baby Dominator that I got.
That's funny. I mean, what did you play at?
Yeah, pizza was good.
What weight did you play at?
165, and then by the time I retired, I was like, at the most 180, like, you know, so.
And you're 6'2".
But I got drafted at 6'2", 142 when I got drafted at 17 years old. So, yeah, I was as thick as a, you know, an old thermometer. That's what it was.
I remember introducing my wife to Ryan Miller at a Sabres function, and he was very friendly and sweet and great. And we walked away, and she had a smile on her face. And I said, "What did you think?" She's like, "Can't believe how skinny he is." And is that like the impression maybe you would have most goalies when you see? I mean, you see them on the ice, and it's all the pads and everything like that. Right. No goalie ever looks skinny on the ice anymore.
Not anymore, though. Like they're much thicker now, I think. But Dominik Hasek was skinny. Ryan Miller was very skinny. Patrick Waugh was not a very strong man, but he had kind of skin and bones. There was a lot of skinny goalies back then. I think it's different a lot. Like you watch even an Alex Lyon, who's not a big guy, but he's got that thickness to him. Luukkonen has got some size. Colton Ellis is like, you don't see 6'2", 170 anymore. Goalies are usually 185 to, you know, somewhere in the low 200s, 210, depending on how big you are. But a Vasilevsky's thick, a Jeremy Swayman's thick, a Jake Ottinger's thick. Like, they're still different now.
You almost got to be, right, Marty, to play, not that you didn't butterfly, but, like, it's so up and down, 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 constantly. Like, that's that power pack area, that core, just the thighs just get big. Like, there's weight right there for guys because just how they're playing.
It's like baseball players, right? They can't find pants. Like, if you ask Devin Levi, you know, like, somebody measured his waist 1 year, and I think it was like a 38 or a 39 waist. I'm like, what? Like, he's 6 foot, maybe, right. And he's got like a 38 waist?
Yeah,
like,
that's my waist. Like, that's incredible, yeah.
Yeah, that's the big waist.
Right.
That's funny.
Marty, speaking of goalies, before we wrap up and run out of time here, like, I'm inclined to just run it back. The three guys are under contract. I think they were a strength of the team during the year. And I don't want to, just because they had to pull guys in and out during the playoffs a few times, overreact to that. What do you think about goaltending? Do you think a going fishing for a big guy is called for? Or do you want to run back the three guys that were here last year?
I mean, the situation was pretty good this year. It worked out. I think it's hard to have a third goalie and just say you're going to play maybe 10, 15 games. Like, that guy, like, it's good for Colton Ellis last year. Like, I'm in the NHL. I'm playing a little bit. I'm making big money. Like, that's good. But do you want to do that again where you're a third right. goalie and you're backing up most nights and the other two are going back and forth? And I think that's going to be complicated, having a third guy. And there's a lot of organizations that are saying, you know, we'll use three goalies. Maybe they'll go 45, 25, and 14, right? That's 84 games. So you use three goalies. But even in that 45, 25, 14, you have a number one. I think that's important. I want a number one guy that I know this is my number one. Whatever happens after that, it's fine. But I don't think the Sabres have that right now. They don't have this is our number one. You know, Lyon was for a bit. Luukkonen was for a bit. Like, it just, it's too undecided for my liking. I know it worked well last year, but did it work well against Montreal going back and forth and back and forth? I don't love that.
I'm not surprised, by the way, to see Carolina end up on this kid over Anderson. Nothing against Anderson. I don't really care that he's had rocky playoff years in the past. I mean, they were winning every night. But this guy, we saw the Sabres play against him, Bussey, and he kind of stole the game. And it's funny, I'm not sure you would say the same here, Marty, but Hurricanes, Canadians, both teams where at times I might have thought their best guy was on the bench. And they were riding one goalie, but maybe that wasn't necessarily their best goalie. And the Sabres went back and forth. So you never know. I mean, cup history, the last 20 years, there are all kinds of goalies that maybe fans wouldn't remember who won it.
Yeah, but at the same time, like Stuart Skinner, Calvin Pickard, Aiden Hill, like I can name you so many goalies that were either in the Stanley Cup Final or have won the Stanley Cup Final that you wouldn't get anywhere close now. You would never say, right, I need Aiden Hill or I need Stuart Skinner. And, you know, that's really, like, I want a guy, and maybe that's Lukanen, maybe that's Lyon, maybe that's Colton Ellis, maybe that's Devon Levi, I don't know. But I want a guy that I'm like, he's mine, and I'm so happy to have him. And, you know, like right now, Carolina could be looking at Brendan Bussey and saying, you know, we were lucky Freddie Anderson went 12-1 in the first three rounds. But at any moment, if he had lost a game in the first round to Ottawa or in the second round, you know, to Philadelphia, like Bussey would have been in there. It's just we didn't need him. But I think they like having Brendan Bussey, and that may be their guy next year. Maybe it's Kochetkov, you know, but they can say we have our guy.
Yep.
The Sabres can't say that right now.
We'll talk about that perhaps going forward here without you. Good luck with the chickens. And this time of year we get to Fridays in the summer and we're often booking fantasy football guests. Are you perhaps inclined to become one on a future show to take questions about drafting? I know you're a player.
I'm a player, but as we did your fantasy, your best ball draft, I don't think we did so well. I'm not good, but I am a player. And also want to give you just a little tidbit. You talked about the 82-0 game. Are you doing the one with Dom's model? Because there's a few games out there, but I think the one that I'm doing has got Dom Lechushin's model, right? And that's a tough one. That's a really tough one.
No, I want to know about that. I don't think that's the one I'm doing. Okay, good. I mean, I'll have to.
I went 81-1. 81-1 is the best I've done on that one, and I actually took a screenshot because usually I'm like 75-5-2 and 74-6-2, and I'm like, it's hard. It's a really tough one.
So I'm going to need to know players' possession stats from memory. Like I'm going to want to draft Cody Franson. I'm one of these teams probably because he always looked so slow to everybody and the fans were impressed, but like, well, they're better when he's on the ice than when Ristolainen's on the ice. Somebody explain that.
And with that game, you can do three modes. China, you can try to go 82-0. You can try to go 41-41, or you can try to go 0-82 because they really give you all the options. They give you like the bench warmers options too.
Oh,
not just the good players.
I want that. I want that. My team at Bulldog, my team, you're rolling your eyes over there. My team would be Franson, Nathan Beaulieu would be on my team.
It's a beautiful summer day in the year 2026 of our Lord, and we're still waging the Cody Franson wars.
I'm sorry.
I cannot even believe this.
I mean, what a better time to do it.
That's right.
Marty, you're the best. Thanks for answering the call. So I'm sorry, were you still trying to make a point? I was saying goodbye.
Yeah, Bulldog's
no, I'm saying Cody Franson. It's like LA acquiring Cody Ceci last summer. They're like, what are you doing? But that's what they do.
Sometimes you got to get a Cody. All right. I echo what Bulldog said. Thanks. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you guys. Enjoy the next couple of games in the NHL, Stanley Cup, the draft in Buffalo free agency.
Right.
It's going to go quick.
For sure. Yeah, the draft in 2 weeks. Thanks again, Marty. Marty Baron on the Western Hotline. The sixth game of the final is Sunday night. When's basketball? Tonight, tomorrow?
Saturday night.
Did I miss?
Yeah.
Blind shot.
Yeah.
I got a light, I got a chair, a backpack. I thought I had the line, overshot it. I've been holding this plump
piece of
paper.
You did have the line. You hit the top of the rail
too
there.
Heavy.
You would if you would have just hit that backboard, you would have been gold.
Marty thinks it's best to have a guy in net. What do we do about it? 803-0550. Mike Schopen, the Bulldog with you. This is WGR. It.
It's a plan.
Joe, preeminent Bengals analyst with us on the Western Hotline. How are you choosing to define expectations for the Bengals this year? I think they're tricky because they've been down in the standings, but the upside is really there. And when I see that they're favored in 15 games, I feel like just saying making the playoffs is light.
Yeah, I was trying to temper my expectations and maybe how I presented them to other people for a while because the defense still after free agency, I didn't feel great about it. And then the Dexter Lawrence trade kind of ruined that for me. I bought in. I was like, man, that's, you get a premium piece on your defense. That could be huge for you. That could, should at least get you moved up to, you know, 16 to 20 in the defensive rankings instead of 30 to 32nd, which they've been for the last 3 years. And I start to go, okay, well, let's really look at this team. And when Burrow's been healthy, they've been good, and they score a lot of points, and they're competitive. It's really been the two injuries, I guess you can say probably three, two injuries in 2023, and then last year getting hurt again with the turf toe. It really sapped their potential for what probably should have been prime years for Joe Burrow's career. Now he still has a few more of those. He's not old yet, but at the same time, you're looking at it like, man, is the pressure there? Do they feel it? Can they see it? Is that why they're going to get Dexter Lawrence? Is that why they're spending money in free agency? Is that why they're restructuring Joe Burrow? And I assume another move is coming with that extra cap space. And if so, maybe 15 games isn't crazy, especially when you look at the schedule. It is not tough at all. So I'm starting to get carried away a little bit, and I don't know if that's just the summer and the football season needing to get here that's allowing me to do that.
Forgive me if this ends up being a stupid question, Joe, but what's your read on, I don't know, the vibes around Burrow? It felt like as last year was ending and even into the winter and early in the spring, there's this concern, and maybe this is just Bengals fans being panicky the way Bills fans used to be panicky about, I don't know, the team leaving or players not wanting to be here. Is there any anxiety about Burrow ending up at the Carson Palmer space on the board?
There is some of that, of course, especially if you've been a fan for a long time. Now, half of the viewers and readers and, you know, people that consume my content jumped on when Burrow was here. So they're kind of fuzzy on the Carson Palmer story. But it was very similar to this. They went to the playoffs the first 2 years. Things felt great. You had Chad Ochocinco, TJ Hushmanzada, Rudy Johnson. Like, you had a stacked offense with a timely defense. And he was the golden armed prospect, number one overall Heisman winner. Everyone felt really good about their potential to get there. And then they don't make the playoffs for three straight years. And Palmer hurts his UCL, misses almost all of 2008. And they have to rebuild and get back to competitive football in 2009. And then things went downhill after that. And they brought in T.O. 2010, and everything just got crazy. And you could see the Bengals were never really going for it. They were never really pushing the chips all in. And Palmer got frustrated with that, and things fell apart, and it hit us like a brick at the time. So could you see it happen again? Of course. I have scars from that, from thinking you're going into the season with one thing, and then you get the Andrew Luck pulled right in front of you. So, you know, it happens, and it is something to be wary of. But at the same time, looking at the contracts, looking at how feasible it would actually be to do these things and how conservative the Bengals typically are and how tight they are, really, in a lot of ways. They didn't want to trade Palmer originally until someone finally offered two potential first-round picks, ended up being a first and a second. There's really no space to do it for another 2 years. And I don't think Joe wants to leave Jamar and T after really pushing to get them paid, and they got paid, and everyone's here, and guaranteed money is still there for the next year and a half. Like, that, I don't think it's happening anytime soon. But it's not a coincidence, I don't think, that the Bengals were like, okay, let's make some all-in moves in this offseason, try and right this ship.
Yeah, I'm glad you got to Higgins and Chase there. I mean, you know, keeping both of them, I can remember talking to you over the years that, like, I just never thought that was a great idea to invest that money there. But I wonder how much organizationally the concern of, you know, making sure they keep Burrow happy. Certainly any team with a franchise quarterback wants to do that. I wonder if, like, acquiescing eventually to keeping both of those receivers played a bigger role in that than maybe it should have.
Some of the most interesting comments this offseason was from general manager, de facto general manager is what we call him, because it's really still Mike Brown, but Duke Tobin runs the show. And he had a postseason and after the season press conference going into the offseason, and he was pretty stern in his response when everyone's like, you feel the pressure to put things around Burrow, to make it right around Burrow, to build the right team for Joe, all these things. And eventually he kind of cracked a little bit and said, well, our quarterback also has to stay healthy, and he has to win these games in big moments at the end. And then he continued to talk about how they can fix the rest of the roster around him. But I thought that was important because, you know, if you leave excuses on the table, I think the fan base will generally side with the player for a long time, especially the franchise quarterback. But once the excuses are kind of gone, you've paid your weapons around. You got Jamar Chase, you got T. Higgins, you've got Mike Gesicki, you got Chase Brown. You're bringing back all five starters on the offensive line that played much better. This is the best offensive line in Burrow's career for sure. And then now we've made moves in free agency. You brought in big free agents, two starting free agents on day one of free agency. You make a big trade 10th overall pick for Dexter Lawrence. You make moves there to ensure that the defense is much better. Well, now the pressure is off the organization in a lot of ways, and it's normally squarely on the organization. I think the pressure is even less on Zach Taylor because we've seen Taylor get an okay roster. They weren't great. No one expected them to make the Super Bowl in 2021, and I don't think people love Zach Taylor on the outside. The organization does, but I think the pressure is off him a little bit and more on Joe Burrow, and it's on Jamar Chase, and it's on T. Higgins. Like, we've paid you guys. It is time to make plays at the end of the game to win these big games and to stay healthy, of course, for Joe Burrow, which to me, that I find that exciting. I find that like, okay, let's put it on the players. Let's see what they do. Let's see how they respond. You guys were having a conversation earlier about greatness. And to me, greatness is different than being the best. Like, Joe Burrow's the best quarterback they've ever had. But is he the greatest? He's not there yet. And I would like to see him get there through these big moments and answering the call when they need it. And we're going to have another shot at that this season.
Oh, man. There's so much to work with there. What is Anderson without the one Super Bowl appearance? He was so good. Like, underrated, criminally underrated, they say, Ken Anderson.
No doubt.
I'd love to play with that. Interesting how the Bengals and the Bills can be compared with each other on this front. How when, if this isn't going too far, Joe, like when organizations just are, their reputations are so entrenched for losing or, you know, being frugal, or if that's even different, just what they were. And then you get a quarterback, as these two teams both did, that looks just like almost too good for the organization. Just, you know, this is impossible. How they almost always get the benefit of the doubt. Allen has had his share of big game losses too, but rarely does anybody really blame him. I mean, once in a while now, Denver was, what, turnovers, and they scored 30 points.
I've been
points.
Kind of pushing back on it the whole time. Like, it was always McDermott in the defense. I'm like, I got the ball with a minute to go. Come on, I expect to win one of these.
There is that school of thought. Yeah. But there's also, like, for every one of those phone calls we get 30 about Brandon Bean.
Right.
And they're 98-50, not including playoffs in the last 8 years. So the Bills and the Bengals, I think, are both teams where a great superstar quarterback can maybe get away with a lot. Not that they necessarily shouldn't at times, but it's almost never, the blame almost never seems to reach them.
I think you're 100% right. And I hear the conversation about the Bills all the time being here. So much of it was on McDermott after these games, right? How many calls did you get on McDermott? Well, now that's not there. If people like Brady, and we'll see how he goes as a head coach, but you could see maybe a little shift towards more of an eye on Allen. And now maybe the excuse is still there that, you know, he doesn't have the weapons, but you make the trade for a receiver, you continue to add to that side of the ball, and at some point that conversation may go there, or the angst may go towards Josh Allen.
Yeah, well, and the coaching change plays into that in more ways than one, because it depends on how you want to perceive it, but Brady, I think in a lot of fans' minds, is Allen's guy, right? He was his quarterback's coach. He got elevated to coordinator when that opening came, and they've hired him as head coach. Of course they're not going to hire a guy as the new head coach replacing McDermott after 9 years that Allen doesn't want. So he's sort of on the, I don't know, he's on the spot now with Brady, I think, to some extent.
And again, like I said, I think that's fun. I think that's okay. Right. If you're looking at it and saying, I want drama, I want to see this guy, I want to see our franchise, our golden boy here with the ball in his hands, down by 6 points with a minute and 40 to go, with one timeout in the AFC Championship game, I want to see that. These are the moments that you remember forever. You want the pressure. You want the spotlight on them. You want them in primetime games so that everyone can watch what we watch for 17 weeks and say, look at this guy. Look how good he is. He is everything that I've been waiting for this franchise, and you just want him to come through in those moments. But to get to that moment and have that pressure is a privilege.
With Joe Goodberry, you mentioned Burrow's age earlier. might be interesting for people to know, he is older than Lamar Jackson. He was drafted 2 years later, but he is a number like a month older than Jackson. Burrow's 29. Jackson's 29. Allen and Mahomes are both 30. Allen just turned 30. Herbert is 28. Nix is 26, even though he's not been in the league for very long, but he came in old. Lawrence is 26 only. Mm. May is 23. Anyone else I want in the AFC? Watson is 30, by the way. Watson is only 30. So
I don't want him.
You don't want him? Forget I mentioned Watson. Joe, that schedule, wow, it's funny how it works. I'm not sure this is the only time in the rotation where a team gets both South divisions, but so many times those are the weak spots. And the AFC
those
North.
Ones you're waiting for, right?
Yes, like every 4 years. And sometimes it just feels like this is always the case where that's really soft, but that's what you've got. We were talking, maybe you were listening, we were talking about the one seed, about the Bills, as we always do every offseason. And I think Cincinnati is a key team in this because you need the other divisions to have to be competitive, I think, probably, so that one team just doesn't run roughshod through it. And the Ravens, or even the Bengals, I suppose, if the Ravens slip, maybe Baltimore is a team that's dangerous in that way. I don't know. I don't think the AFC West will have that. I think it's too good. And if Jacksonville and Houston are both good, then maybe the South won't either. The Bills might need Cincinnati in a weird way to hang around and, you know, battle Baltimore to end up with Buffalo as the one seed. And maybe that's, you know, the other way around too. You might feel like you need New England.
Yep.
Exactly what I was going to say. It's kind of like the, you know, you when the Tom Brady era Patriots were going and they just ran through the AFC East, it was like, okay, they're going to win 14 games, right? Just because they go pretty much almost every time 5-1 or 6-0 in the division. But yeah, and the AFC North has been so tough for a long time. Hopefully the Steelers are taking a step back or maybe more indecision and definitely not taking a step forward with Aaron Rodgers. Hopefully not, and for my sake. But, you know, if you can look at Baltimore and say, I don't know that they got better in a big way. I mean, Trey Hendrickson is a great pass rusher, and they had some pass rush issues last year. But they have a lot of holes, and that offensive line has a lot of issues still. They need a lot of young guys to step up and step their game up in a big way and become big players for them. But if I were just looking at the rosters and saying one for one, the Bengals are probably edging out the Ravens just a little bit. I think the Ravens are still slight favorite from betting odds, but I think it's really, really close. And for the Bengals specifically, they need to come out hot again. That story hasn't gone away, really. I think they are two different offenses a lot of times early in the year versus what they end up being. Midpoint and then, you know, towards the end of the year, they seem to be a team that figures it out as they go. But that's going to ruin your chance of getting a number one seed or fighting for it. If you're starting off 1-2 or 2-2, well, it's, you know, the one number one seed, you better rattle off 10 wins at some point to catch yourself back up to it. And the Bengals really haven't shown that early season get off the way that a number one seed typically needs to have.
You know, Joe, anytime we visit with someone who covers and talks about and writes about another team, I'm going to pop the Our Lads depth chart open on my desktop. And It really stands out looking at the Bengals on offense and on defense. And this isn't surprising. It's just another way to make an example of how much work they felt needed to be done on defense. The starter column on the Our Lads offense is all the same color. It's all guys that have been there. There's no purple. There's no green. There's no orange. There's nothing. It's all static, right? There are three spots on the second team offense where there are draft picks, and they're all mid-round guys, fourth through sixth round. The defense, on the other hand, has four new guys in the starter column, all free agents, and then there's three more guys on the second team, two draft picks and another free agent. So you got seven guys, you know, seven spots on the defensive depth chart on the first, you know, two rungs of it that are new. Obviously four starting spots. So that just really jumped out at me. I very rarely see that kind of disparity team to team when, you know, I'm doing this exercise looking at whomever we're talking to. But it really stands out with you guys.
There's one player on defense left from the 2021, 2022, 2 years of Super Bowl AFC Championship, and that's B.J. Hill at defensive tackle. Everyone else was either drafted in 2022 or after, didn't play much. Dax Hill was 2022, didn't play much his rookie year. So everyone pretty much is afterwards. And then you're right, it's a lot of free agents, and it's a lot of guys they drafted in the last 2-3 years. They have seen the writing on the wall. I think that part one was that they knew if they're going to pay Burrow and Chase and Higgins, they're going to have to invest through the draft on defense, and they're going to lose some free agents along the way. And so that was prepared for. They tried to draft a bunch of guys. A lot of them did not pan out. And when you do that, you're in a hole right away. So what they have to do to counteract that, they had to go out in free agency, and they had to get guys like Jonathan Allen and Dexter Lawrence and Boye Mafe and Kyle Duggar and Brian Cook. So, you know, if those guys can pan out for you, if they're veterans that can stabilize you, I don't think there's a better one-for-one replacement in free agency than, no offense to you guys and to Geno Stone, but from Geno Stone to Brian Cook, from one of the worst tacklers in the league, and effort-wise, Stone is probably the poster child for a lot of Bengals fans for their defense the last 2 years. To go to Brian Cook, who's one of the better tackling free safeties in the league, very steady player for the Chiefs the last 3 years. He's been there 4 years, but last 3 years starting. That one-for-one replacement at that position where the Bengals have a lot of issues since losing Jesse Bates and Von Bell, they're expecting that to be a big boost to their communication and what they can do on the back half again, the way they used to when they had good safeties. That's the big one for me, other than Dexter Lawrence, we already talked about. But the pass rush, big for them. After losing Trey Hendrickson, they brought in Jonathan Allen at defensive tackle, who was probably playing too many snaps, former first-round pick. They think they can reduce his snaps and get him in a pass rush role and extend his career. Boye Mafe, coming off a Super Bowl run with the Seahawks, very good postseason, as an edge rusher, day one signing as well in free agency. And then they draft Cassius Howell out of Texas A&M with their first pick, which they have a second-round pick, who is a pass rush specialist. So I think they're going to try and manufacture it with a wave of 8 guys coming at you rather than just Trey Hendrickson.
Just a couple minutes left with Joe Goodberry. You slipped in a reference to the Steelers earlier. What do you actually expect?
I don't know, to be honest. They're a collection of individual talents that I like and players that I like. Like, on his own, I like DK Metcalf. On his own, I like Michael Pittman. On his own, I like Jaylen Warren. But together, the offense was dysfunctional in a lot of ways, and that's why they probably went out and got McCarthy and wanted to start over on that side of the ball. The offensive line's got some issues in terms of – I thought they secured their interior offensive line the last couple of years. And then Troy Fautanu, their former first-round pick, probably going to play left tackle. They spend their first-round pick on a right tackle this year, so maybe that'll get secured and they'll be okay. I like Darnell Washington as a player at tight end. I like Pat Freiermuth at tight end. So as a collection, I like the individual guys on offense. You can say the same about the defense. They have individual stars on that side. But something seems dysfunctional, or did, under Tomlin at the end there. And maybe that's the boost they need to recover and just reset things by getting McCarthy in here. But I'm not a big fan of Mike McCarthy. I thought his offense was archaic in a lot of ways, very stagnant, not a lot of motion, not a lot of creativity. They're not going to scheme a lot of things up. So you need these weapons to make plays one-on-one. And maybe they have enough to do that. But overall, I don't think it's a very good roster. And I think they've got some really exploitable holes that I hope the other teams can take advantage of. I'm tired of seeing the Steelers get into the playoffs with a winning record, and maybe it'll be different without Tomlin, and then just get absolutely destroyed in the wild card round.
That's another thing that's annoying, isn't it? And Baltimore would feel the same way, maybe at least last couple of times when Pittsburgh gets in.
Where are you on Baltimore, Joe?
They're going to be a pain because Lamar Jackson is a freak show at quarterback, and still he's gotten more efficient as he's gone on, and that means their offense is going to be good, despite holes on the offensive line, despite not having – I mean, Zay Jones is a good receiver, but is he like an alpha number one? I don't know if he is. I don't know if you need one, especially when they can run the ball the way they do and they have good tight ends with Mark Andrews. They lost Isaiah Likely, which I think will actually be a big hit towards them. But on defense, I think they're slow at corner. They're getting older at that position. They were exploitable at safety last year, and their pass rush was bad. But they got Trey Hendrickson, so that does that offset. Can that get them back where they need to be? I think they're going to be tough because, again, they got Lamar.
Joe, I'm glad to hear the friendship seems to be trending up. The season's still a ways away, so hopefully we get to talk to you again before then. What's the best way for us to help you make money? What can we tell, or have you tell people to subscribe to Joe Goodberry?
That's a great question, because I just put my notice in at my day job of 11 years. And so that's over because I just started and am now one of the co-hosts of the Locked On Bengals podcast,
good for
along
you.
With the other things I do. So it's kind of offsetting. And if I'm not going to take the leap now, when am I going to do it? I'm 39 years old and I've been doing this for my 18th season covering the Bengals. Best place to find me to find all of that is on Twitter at Joe Goodberry.
Congrats.
Yeah.
You got a
good to hear.
Thank you.
Feel good. Maybe it's a little bit nerve-wracking, but that's normal.
Sure. Yeah.
Got to be taking the plunge, but liberating too, so good for you.
Thank you.
Not to, give away too much. So many people I know have bet on themselves, as they say, and made it work. And I know from your following, you'd be a great bet on having that happen as well. Thanks for today, Joe.
Thanks, guys. We'll talk soon.
Joe Goodberry on the Wester Hotline. The Bengals open with the Bucks. They've never played.